Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Verrill, committed to delivering trusted legal services in Maine and throughout the Northeast for 163 years. Learn more at verrill-law.com.
Today on Maine Calling, how Maine schools are supposed to accommodate students with disabilities. Every child in Maine is guaranteed by law the right to a free and appropriate public education. For students with disabilities, what does that mean? For some, it's physical access, wheelchair ramps, and elevators. For many others, it's an individualized education program to accommodate their developmental disability. But meeting those goals can be complicated, expensive, and difficult for families and for schools. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we continue our series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. On this program, we focus on the experience of students, preschool through 12th grade and beyond. We'll learn what the law requires, how federal funding cuts might affect students with disabilities, and what opportunities there are beyond high school. Maine Calling is just ahead. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Navigating school can be tricky enough for any student, but for many young people in Maine, there are extra obstacles. We'll explore the services and programs in place to help those who have physical, developmental, or other disabilities, and what happens when those services are not available. This show is part of the Maine Calling series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. We are streaming it live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Calling's Facebook page with an ASL interpreter. Joining me for this hour, Carrie Woodcock, who is Executive Director of the Maine Parent Federation, Atlee Riley, who is Managing Attorney for Education Advocacy with Disability Rights Maine, and Dylan Campbell, Parent Trainer and Youth Coordinator with the Maine Parent Federation. We invite you to join the conversation. Has you or your child needed individualized education program? Have they run into problems at their school? Or has there been a great experience you'd like to share? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Carrie, I'm going to start with you. Do you have a sense of how many students in Maine, or maybe what percentage, have some kind of disability?
So we know that in Maine, about 20% of our students in schools have an individualized education program. We're higher than the national average. I would say some of the reasons for being higher than the national average is that we are lower than the national average when it comes to our birth to two identification for early intervention services. So some of those children who aren't getting the earlier intervention services end up needing a higher level of care when they enter kindergarten. So we All right, do over yeah. our state right now.
Yeah, and I know it's tricky to have definitions sometimes, but when we talk about a student who's living with a disability, how is that defined in terms of the schools and education?
Well, it really needs to be individualized. There are 13 different criteria a student can be categorized under to receive special education programming. And so a school needs to look at the individual and determine their eligibility for special ed under one of those criteria. Each of those criteria have different eligibility forms that need to be filled out. To be determined eligible, typically there is a process in which a student goes through a multi-tiered systems of support, which takes about 6 weeks to identify if what has been identified as perhaps a disability can be actually, a student can access their education through in classroom support in the mainstream classroom. At the same time, we always recommend that the student is going through an evaluation process, which once a student or once a parent signs consent for that evaluation process, the school has 45 school days to conduct the evaluation. and then hold an IEP meeting to review those evaluations and determine if the student is eligible for a disability and to receive specialized instruction within the classroom.
At least students with disabilities are entitled to a quote, free and appropriate public education. What does that mean, free and appropriate? And I imagine that that second word, appropriate, can mean different things to different people.
Sure. Without getting too far into the weeds, a free and appropriate public education is a little bit of a cyclical definition. But the way I like to think about it is, what does this child need to have full and equal access to the general education curriculum? That's essentially the crux of it. And then for a very, very small percentage of students, it means what do they need to meet appropriately ambitious goals to ensure that they can move through school and be as prepared as possible for post-school activities, which include employment, independent living, and further education and training. So for most students, at bottom, what a free and appropriate public education means is giving them what they need so they can have access to the general education curriculum.
It's interesting what you said about appropriate goals, because that was a big question I had about expectations. And I'm wondering if that is, in my lifetime, from the outside looking in, it seems to me that we have a better understanding of what some goals might be for people with disabilities, students with disabilities, that we are raising our expectations and we're raising those goals. Is that right?
Well, we should be, because children sure have a way of rising to the expectations we have, and unfortunately, the opposite is also true. Students with disabilities have been subjected to, for decades, pervasively low expectations. And so, I hope what you say is true. I see some evidence of that. One hopeful sign, and maybe someone from the Department of Education will talk about it, but there was just last week a conference focused on inclusion, it was a full house at the Civic Center, and people looking for ways and support to design our schools, universally design our schools, so they meet the needs of all children, and that will benefit all children. So I hope what you say is true, but nobody calls me when they're happy. And I'm sure you'll ask some other questions, but the reality I see out there, because no one calls me when they're happy, is where that's not true yet. And we have a long, long way to go. But at times I really try to choose to be hopeful, and last week was one of those times.
All right. Well, Dylan, I want to ask you what it's like on the ground. Do school districts usually meet this standard of free and appropriate public education without a fight? Or do families have to work hard to advocate for their children?
So that's a heavy question, Jen, but I'll try to answer it the best I can. From my experience, it varies district by district. So the services and supports that one student will receive in one district will vary differently from another district as well. So a lot of the work that I try to do is supporting youth and young adults and identifying what are the steps that they can do. So how can we help support them in self-advocacy and being able to understand what they can ask for and who the appropriate channels might be? So to answer that varies district by district, but there's work that's happening. And in Maine, I think we're in a very good spot. There's a lot of initiatives happening to support youth and young adults to be able to know what are the next steps, what can I ask for?
And Dylan, you're a young man now, but I'm wondering if you have a disability and if you attended Maine schools, how did it go?
So I did attend Maine schools. I identify with anxiety and mental health. I did not have an IEP growing up, but I did have multiple siblings. So I'm 27 now, and since I've been doing this work since I was 19, we've really grown this type of work in supporting youth and young adults. What first started off as simple presentations to going into schools to help youth and young adults learn about self-advocacy has really changed and grown into other initiatives as well. I'm sure I'll get a chance to share later on, but I'm also involved with our Maine Department of Education. And one of the things that we do is we host a youth summit each year with the theme I Belong. And this is to show youth and young adults that they belong in different career fields. They belong in higher education institutions. So always trying to use that lived experience and bring that back to our youth and young adults as well.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Carrie, do you find you work with a lot of parents And I'm sure you're helping a lot of parents, you know, fight for their child in their own school district. But you also find that the reality is in Maine that many people will move to a district that has a good reputation.
You would find that nationally. People will state hop, people will district hop based upon the experiences they're hearing from other parents about their children with different abilities, being able to access the systems of care within school, be included, and have their IEP needs met. So yes, that's a very common experience for parents to do, is to be able to check out what other districts are offering and have their child attend those districts because they feel like their needs will be easier met. We work with parents on a regular basis. One of the things we try to tell parents is from year to year, it'll be different. From one school to the next, it's usually different. From year to year, it's usually different. It's identifying the champion within the school to help you access the services that you need for your youth and young adult. But it's also working with your youth and young adult, as Dylan does and mentioned, to have a voice. There's no better advocacy than the students advocating for their own needs. And we try to tell parents that the voices that need to be heard and that will be listened to most times are the students' voices. So I know all of us, Dylan, Atlee, and myself, work really hard to make sure that youth-led individualized education program meetings are happening, that youth are attending their own meetings, and that we're accommodating and modifying so that they can attend and have a voice. Because that voice is usually the voice that teachers and administrators alike want to hear from. Nobody's sitting around those tables wanting to do harm by students. It is hard sometimes to meet the needs. And so getting creative and listening to the student voice is usually the best practice.
You know, I'm so interested in what you're saying. Sometimes it is hard. I can imagine, especially for the smallest school districts, it can be challenging. And I'm wondering what you mean by creative solutions.
Well, I would tell you one of the things I've done as a parent for my daughter, who's now 18, just turned 18 this weekend and has Down syndrome. I try to come up with some outside the box ideas. Inclusion is a big challenge sometimes for these students, especially with a cognitive disability. And for Sammy, one of the things I've done in working with her school is to try to use their electives in high school to meet some of her core curriculum needs so she can still access the mainstream classroom. So one of the unique things we did this year was we took advantage of the Acting One class to meet Sammy's English credits because acting enables her to access a literature piece, but also works on her goals of being able to read, follow punctuation, and some writing goals as well. So we got creative and thought outside the box. And instead of Sammy ending up in a resource room, which would not be with the mainstream population, she ended up in an acting class, which she truly loves and is meeting her credits for high school English that way. So one of the things when we come to the table at Maine Parent Federation is we try to take those type of outside the box ideas to think about the workforce shortage that's occurring. How do we meet the students' needs and how can we get creative without necessarily having to go through a complaint or due process? So trying to meet everybody's needs at that table and bringing those creative thoughts forward.
Calling in now is Aaron Frazier, who is Director of the Office of Special Services and Inclusive Education with the Maine Department of Education. Thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
What is the Department of Education, the State Department of Education's role in helping to ensure that these necessary services are available to students with disability?
Well, we have a large role in supporting individual education programs or IEPs, which in high school or at age of 14 begin to include a transition plan, which is really directed to help students attain their goals for after-school completion in the area of independent living or post-secondary education and employment goals. So we really provide a lot of technical assistance in those areas for schools. We monitor compliance with those aspects of the IT. And then in the Department of Education, we also have a transition specialist who works with schools to try to focus this work and grow this work in Maine.
As we have been following, there's been a lot of turmoil and threats of funding for education, cuts to funding for education from the federal level. We know that the Trump administration wants to eliminate the federal Department of Education. What does that mean for the state DOE and for Maine students with disabilities?
Well, Maine, like every other state in the nation, is really concerned about some of the activity that's happening around potentially limiting the amount of funds and federal funds. I'm limited in what I can say on that topic due to ongoing litigation, but we're closely monitoring this dynamic situation. At this time, our federal funds are flowing, and we continue to do the work to support students. I do urge those who are concerned about the loss of funding to contact their congressional delegation to bring awareness to how important the programs are that federal funding supports.
Erin, if someone's listening to this program right now and maybe they have a student with a disability, maybe they're thinking of moving to Maine, what resources do they have? Where can they turn?
They can turn to my team, my Department of Education, Office of Special Services and Inclusive Education. We have a lot of resources. We have a lot of resources on our website. We're also developing a website for transition exclusively. We also have a lot of different initiatives and activities to support students in this age range, including a youth summit, I Belong, which is running again this year on May 29th, which introduces students to different businesses and work opportunities. We have an executive student transition committee. I think you may have a member on this call. And then we have lots of initiatives to support schools in addressing this work. So they could contact our office or any of the resources we have on our website. But we do have a really significant amount of resources allocated to this topic.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for calling in. Erin Frazier with the Maine Department of Education, Office of Special Services and Inclusive Education. Today, we are continuing our series that we call Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. Today, we're talking about students and education. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What is it like for students who have disabilities when it comes to public school and being able to thrive in the classroom? With me, Atlee Riley, Managing Attorney for Education Advocacy with Disability Rights Maine, and two guests with the Maine Parent Federation, Dylan Campbell, who is a parent trainer and youth coordinator, and Carrie Woodcock, Executive Director. Share your comments and questions. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. And a reminder, today's program is streaming live on Maine Public's YouTube channel and Maine Calling's Facebook page with an ASL interpreter. Atlee, we've been focusing really on public schools so far, but private schools, what are their obligations to students? Are they the same as those for public schools?
It depends, the famous like first part of an attorney answer. But for the most part in Maine, with some exceptions, private schools have obligations as places of public accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act and also under the State Human Rights Act. It really kind of goes back to what I was saying about the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, when it boils down to it, is children are entitled to equal access to the program and activities of those schools. So it means that you can't be excluded from participation, enrollment, or participation in the benefits and services of the activities of that school because of your disability. It also means that to the extent reasonable accommodations and modifications are required to give you equal access, that's required. That's a over reduction, but given the time that we have, I think that should be good enough.
We'll turn to Daphne, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Daphne, go ahead. Daphne, can you hear me? Go ahead.
Yes, I can. Yes, thank you for taking my call. My name is Daphne Gregory Thomas, and I am calling to just be a cheerleader for everything that you're speaking about. I'm actually just finishing a book about this very thing. I was involved in the 1990s, quite by accident, with a group of students who were isolated in the back of the library who had IEPs. And even though they were classified, very often, you know, it was felt appropriate, just put them in a room. And the their story is that they decided themselves that they needed to explain to the powers that be and advocate for themselves. It was an anomaly at the time. Again, as they learned more about what their classification meant, they felt that people didn't fully understand what their strengths were, that what was considered disabilities presented an opportunity for them to shine in other ways. They had to be strategic. And the word transition was just being spoken about at the time. Of course, it evolved into transition services once the students began to advocate. And so the work that you're doing now, which I feel has fallen by the wayside, it's so important. Just to put a pin on the importance, once these students began to advocate for themselves, as Dylan is talking about, they were noticed. It was so important. And they literally, in 2004, ended up in front of a joint session of Congress students to help with the reauthorization of IDEA for this purpose.
Daphne, thank you. Yeah, thank you for calling and sharing that story. And I'm going to turn to you, Dylan, because basically we've heard from both Carrie and Daphne now the power that students themselves have in advocating for their own change. But there is a little part of me, Dylan, and maybe it's as a parent, thinking, boy, that's an awful lot to put on kids.
Yeah, it is. But one of the things I think is, you know, even young adults and older adults, a lot of people don't understand the power of their story as well. So I think what we're trying to do is, you know, we're not expecting our youth and young adults to make all the change. But what we're really trying to do is get them involved at that young age. So by the time that they start their careers, they can, you know, be in these circles, be in these professional circles. One of the things that I always tell my youth and young adults that I work with is that Maine is a big geographic state, but it's really just one big small town. So we need to really emphasize the importance of networking and how youth and young adults can get involved in these circles and then have those opportunities. I wanted to highlight a couple of the youth that we've been working with this year as well, where I invited them to the call today, but they're still currently in high school. And honestly, I've probably had them take too many days off of school this year. But, you know, they've had the opportunity in the past year or two to speak on multiple panels, you know, at state level, at local level. They've had the opportunity to, you know, partner with their school alongside the state of Maine to create events for their schools. So while I agree, I think it is a lot to put on youth and young adults, I believe that there's different ways that we can do that and different ways we can get them involved, whether that is speaking at a testimonial, submitting a letter, or doing something smaller local in their community as well.
All right. Well, Daphne, thanks for your call. We're going to turn now to Shelley King, who is Project Director for Youth and Adult Transition Services for Maine Care with Maine DHHS. Thanks for calling in, Shelley.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Yeah, we've already been talking a little bit about thinking about education for students with disabilities in terms of what's next and what happens after high school. Tell us what typically happens to these young people when they reach adulthood.
Well, you know, I just heard Dylan talking about the importance of networking and community supports, and I can't help but echo that so strongly. A really important piece of transitioning for youth and students is really, you know, the importance of them and their families and the special educators working with them to invite representatives from agencies and providers who may be able to help support them after they graduate and after they leave those school settings. Atlee spoke of their goals long term of employment and living independently. And really, we hope that individuals with developmental disabilities may be able to have some supports from Office of Aging and Disability Services later. But you think sometimes about, you know, what about a student who may have floated in a life jacket for 12 years, right? You wouldn't expect them to swim if you took their life jacket off. And so, you know, with that type of analogy, you know, we really want to be able to have everybody come to the table and have a conversation together about how can we help support that individual once their life jacket comes off and they're no longer in school.
And Shelley, you know, you hear these stories anecdotally about how somebody, you know, did so well in high school and maybe stayed in high school a couple extra years, and then they're in their young 20s and are, you know, living with their parents. The parents don't know where to turn. Are those stories becoming less and less common, or is that still the reality for many families?
Sadly, it's for individuals with developmental disabilities, and that's the group that I work with. So, you know, it's the realm that I am able to speak. It's sadly still the reality right now. But I do have to say that we are working vigorously on a new lifespan waiver. And many of the individuals that are on this call have been a party to giving information to help us build that lifespan waiver.
What is that, a lifespan waiver?
Yeah, so the lifespan waiver is proposed to begin in 2026. We hope that it will help individuals to become more independent in their life and use funding to have supportive connections. Things like benefit counseling, employment exploration, family empowerment and system navigation, respite, transportation, and supports like that. Really more innovative services is what we're hoping to empower individuals with in the future.
Well, Shelley, thanks so much for calling in and taking part of this conversation. Shelley King was with Maine DHHS, the Youth and Adult Transition Services Department for Maine Care. Thank you, Shelley. On the line with us now is Angelina Puya, who is a ninth grade student at Erskine Academy. Angelina, thanks so much for calling in during the school day.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what happened to you a few years ago that changed your life.
I had a triple hip stroke. It hit my brainstem and spinal cord. I am paralyzed from the neck down, but I am gaining function back.
Wow. Well, tell me about your day. Yeah, I understand that you're doing physical therapy and going to school. What does a day look like for you?
So typically I get to school 7 o'clock. School starts at 7:40, so I'm usually just hanging out till then. And then I go to my school day, which is different depending on the day.
Do you find that you are have challenges in your school that you didn't expect?
Not really. I know in the past couple years, I've switched to doing everything, mostly everything digital. So I have an iPad that I use for school.
And have your teachers and the school administration helped you figure that out?
They have, as well as the hospital that I've been to along the way.
I understand that you have been influential as the school, as Erskine Academy, looks to some renovations.
Yes, I am the first student to be in a long-term wheelchair. Well, we were doing renovations over the summer. They made just a few small changes, keeping in mind that I was coming to the school.
So what kind of changes did they make that maybe they wouldn't have thought of if you were not there?
There's a new outdoor pavilion outside the cafeteria for students to eat lunch. They had to put a ramp there. And they just moved out a couple spaces in the building. Would have been a bump.
So your presence, your involvement has made things better for future students who you don't even know yet.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about your goals. I understand you are aiming for a day when you no longer need to use that wheelchair.
I might always use it some, but I'm hoping to definitely be able to walk the stage for my graduation in a few years.
Well, I hope that for you as well. And Angelina, I know you're only a ninth grader, so this is a big question, but what are you thinking about for after high school?
I'm looking into three careers, an engineer, lawyer, or architect right now.
Those are very good goals. Thank you so much. Is there anything before we let you go, anything you'd like to add, anything that you think other people ought to know about your experience or the experience of other people facing physical disabilities in the school?
No, but there is one message I would like to share, and it's that if we don't advocate for ourselves and others, people aren't going to know what needs to be changed.
Very well said. Angelina Puya, thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling today, and good luck to you. I just know you're going to be able to walk across the stage at graduation.
Thanks for having me.
And Angelina is in ninth grade attending Erskine Academy. Carrie, it seems if there's a theme to today's program, it's make your voice heard, and especially if you are that student.
Yeah, I mean, we work with families all the time, and we teach assertive advocacy. And really what assertive advocacy is what do you bring to the table so that your voice can be heard, and so that you don't get overlooked, or that your style of aggressiveness might get you labeled. And so it's about bringing the data to the table, prioritizing your needs, looking at your top three requests, and how to actively use the system and understand the laws and the language of the laws to get your needs met. And so really that's about strengthening your voice, is trying to take those tools to make your voice heard so that you can have an individualized plan for your children or as a youth and young adult yourself.
One thing I'm hearing and reading about Atlee recently is sort of a little bit of pushback right now against some of the diagnoses and the expectation that schools work with those diagnoses, hearing from some members of the current administration that perhaps ADHD and is overdiagnosed or other behavioral health problems. And I'm wondering, Atlee, if you're already sensing the same kind of thing here in Maine, that maybe some resistance to help for certain diagnoses.
I mean, honestly, I think if you send a child to three different evaluators, you're going to get three different constellations of diagnoses. And so what I'm more interested in is what are the presenting needs of that child, and how do we meet those needs? And that's really an approach that can work for every single child, which is why you talk about universally designing schools. And so you identify the needs that a child has, and you meet those needs. That's what we should be engaged in, and not getting caught up in labels and things of that nature. I will say, though, where you ended in the question is I wouldn't want today to go by without saying this, is that there's a lot of concern about behavior in schools right now. And a lot of push for potentially giving some good people some bad tools, right? Going back to times where, we can expel a, kindergartner or first grader, or, long-term suspend. And the vast majority of our day, my day and the other attorney who works with me at Disability Rights Maine, is helping kids just get access to the schoolhouse door. And that we're still having to do that in 2025. Because they're being excluded due to their unmet behavioral health needs, and because we're using kind of punitive responses to behavior. There was a presentation at the Education Committee yesterday, and some researchers basically concluded after doing a large survey that, documented a lot of increased behavior in schools, that teachers just aren't feeling prepared, they aren't receiving the training, and that we're not implementing interventions with fidelity. And so we need to listen to what's happening in schools, and we need to give teachers the tools that they need.
That's a really good point because we're really focusing on the students and the students' needs. But you're saying a really, really important part of this is what the teachers need, especially when we're dealing with maybe disruptive behaviors.
Right. Ross Green often says, like, kids do well if they can. And I'd like to extend that grace to the teachers. And they're telling us right now that they need support, and they need support from their administration. And the administrators need support from the State Department of Education, so that we implement research-based effective interventions and we don't continue to exclude children with disabilities because of unmet behavioral health needs.
Dylan, there are people listening to this program right now who, when they went to school, other students with disabilities weren't even in the classroom with them. For people of a certain age, and I include myself in this, if a student couldn't see, couldn't hear, was in a wheelchair, they were not in the same classroom with you. And I'm wondering if you want to talk about what it means for everybody else when that student is in the classroom, when the student who learns differently, who moves differently, is in a mainstream classroom.
Yeah, you know, I think it really benefits everyone. So as I sit here, I think I'm the youngest one in the call. You know, I'm always shocked by how new a lot of these concepts or ideas are. One of the things I had recently learned about was the closing of Pine Tree. That had only happened in 1996.
Pineland, yeah.
Pineland, my apologies. So from my perspective, it's almost mind-blowing how fast things have shifted, how fast things have changed, but how insecure it all really is in the end, how fast it could all revert and change back. I really think that there's a huge benefit because if we don't see these individuals in our classrooms, you know, we're not going to give our youth and young adults the opportunity to really have that inclusive lifestyle. You know, we need to involve our youth and young adults in all parts of the schoolroom, because frankly, there's no resource room in the adult world. When our youth and young adults go into post-secondary education, they go into employment, they aren't necessarily getting those supports and services that they once received. But if we include them in the classroom, we give all students the ability to be able to, you know, work with individuals that may have differences as well. So
We are talking about students with disabilities in Maine. This is part of our special series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today's program is part of our year-long series, Ready and Able, Living with a Disability in Maine. We're talking about the challenges for Maine students with disabilities and some of the services that are available. Our guest today, Dylan Campbell, who is the Maine Parent Federation parent trainer and youth coordinator. Carrie Woodcock is also the Maine Parent Federation. She's the executive director. And Atlee Riley is an attorney with Disability Rights Maine. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, or send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. On the line with us now, Sarah Howorth is associate professor and program coordinator for special education graduate programs at the University of Maine. Sarah, thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, nice to be here.
So I understand part of your work involves finding ways for technology to help students with disabilities, including, you say it, artificial intelligence. How can artificial intelligence help students with disabilities?
Well, artificial intelligence is just the newest technology that has become popular in the media right now, but technology has always been used to support students with disabilities, both low tech and high tech. It just is about creating opportunities and inroads for individuals with disabilities across the lifespan to access materials for their learning. So for example, we have calculators. We have even things like a chalkboard was once considered a technology. So that's how I look at using artificial intelligence as a technology to support students with disabilities. For example, some of the chatbots that are available right now, whether they are ChatGPT or Claude or Gemini, you know, there's lots of different versions of that. They can be used to support executive functioning skills or planning skills for students. You've been speaking today about students with attention deficit disorder. They can also be used just as a thought partner to help brainstorm for students with disabilities. And I've even spoken with many teachers, both here in Maine and across the nation, who use them to help adjust text levels for students who struggle with reading so that they can be included with their typical peers in things like science and social studies.
How far off are these kind of technologies from being used widely in Maine? Are we talking about next year or 10 years from now?
Well, I mean, you had Aaron Fraser on from the Office of Special Services and Inclusive Education, but the Maine has been a trailblazer in the nation for using technology ever since Angus King was our governor. He was the first governor to support one-to-one devices for all students in K-12 schools. And so we really have a reputation in our state of being trailblazers. We currently have guidance that is available on the Maine Department of Education website for teachers and families. That are, you know, it's publicly available through the Maine Learning Technology Initiative. There are states across the nation who are developing similar guidelines for how AI can be used by both educators and students. And even at the university level, this is a daily conversation I have with both my students and my colleagues. So it's here. I don't think it's in the future. It's happening right now. Recent surveys of college students have even said that over 90% of them are currently using AI to support their learning. And that is something that we're dealing with in higher ed.
Wow. Well, thank you, Sarah, for calling in. Sarah Howorth is with UMaine Special Education Graduate Programs. We're going to turn to Glenn, who's calling from Searsmont. Hi, Glenn. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm a elementary school principal at a couple of schools in RSU 71, which is the Belfast School District. And we have instituted inclusive practices at Ames Elementary School this past year. And what we found is that the test scores of students with disabilities has gone, they have gone way up, but also there's been a great rise in all test scores. And so that all, we've basically taken the range and just shifted it to the right for all students. And it's been great to see success at all levels. And also the sense of belonging that kids have being in the classrooms has reduced some of the behavioral issues. So it's a good approach all around.
I'm really curious, when you say inclusive practices, what are some of the changes?
Well, for 2 years, we struggled to find a special education teacher. So our classroom teachers really stepped up and said, well, we'll just have the kids in the classroom. So it was kind of a homegrown approach where we just had the students in the classroom all the time, or most of the time, not all the time. And we've really tried to shift that. So more and more time in the classroom as we become more adept at meeting the needs in the classroom. But the goal is to have students in the classroom as much as possible. And that's increasing every year.
So interesting, because it sounds to me as though you ran a pilot program because of necessity. You didn't plan it. You didn't apply for a grant, but you couldn't find a special education teacher, and you just tried to figure it out.
That's correct. It's worked out. It's worked well.
Wow. Can you give us, you know, I know it's, I'm putting you on the spot, and I appreciate you calling in, but I'm just so curious. Can you give me an example of maybe how a classroom looks different today, or how a teacher would teach something differently than a couple of years ago?
Sure. Well, somebody was talking about universal design a little bit earlier. So just creating lessons that we refer to them as high ceiling, low floor, where there are multiple entry points so that the lesson can be adapted to a number of needs academically. And also we've been experimenting with having students randomly grouped and just seeing how that works out. And there's been some great surprises in just randomly grouping students and some surprises. We think that students are going to perform a certain way, but when we put them into random groups, we see strengths that we might not be aware of until we put them in that situation. So random grouping has been a big change in how we look at our approach to education, and it's been a positive change.
Well, Glenn, I'm so glad that you took the time to call in and share with us. Glenn calling from Searsmont, an elementary school principal there. Thank you so much. We'll go to Mary, who's calling from Monmouth. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Mary, can you hear us? Can you go ahead? Well, darn. Okay, we'll go to Joyce, who's calling from Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Joyce, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm a naturopathic physician with an area of expertise in environmental medicine. And there are many, many students that are chemically injured, and chemical injury is protected under the ADA. And I would highly recommend that parents look into the books by Dr. Doris Rapp, R-A-P-P, a pediatrician who wrote the book, Is This Your Child? Is This Your Child's World? Is This Your Child's School? And they have done studies showing that when they cleaned up the chemical toxicity in the classrooms, that a student's behaviors improved, their learning improved. It's very, very clear. So it's considered to be a silent disability. The children are not in wheelchairs and they don't have visual or auditory impairment. But chemical injury from multiple sources.
Thank you, Joyce, for calling and sharing that. I'm going to move on just because we have so little time. Thank you so much for calling in. Jane on Facebook writes, please say more about universal design. As an adult with ADHD, I'm just hearing about it. So, Atlee, I'm going to turn back to you because I believe you brought it up. We heard a little bit from the principal who just called in. But what do we mean by universal design? We mean a lot more than just having doors that automatically open without a handle, right?
So there's probably five or six really great definitions I should be able to just spout, but zooming out again, it's just really anticipating the needs that have arrived. Folks have different strengths and needs, and you can design learning environments where you anticipate most of those. And a lot of it comes down to choice. So giving people choices in how they show you what they know, how they take in information. So how do you receive information, and how do you communicate information? And are there choices in how you do that so that you can elect just as part of the typical classroom environment, like it sounds like what's going on in the school where the principal just called in, that there's going to be intentional design to anticipate what folks' needs are, just as part of the everyday that's available to all folks. And then that really limits the amount of specialized instruction you have to do because you've intentionally designed your learning environment or your space.
Carrie.
Just to piggyback on what Atlee's saying, universal design of learning is something that should be happening in every classroom because we all learn differently. So what it does is it recognizes that you have different learners in your classroom regardless of your ability. And one of the greatest examples I could give was my son's fifth grade teacher. My son has dyslexia, and during our parent-teacher conference, he said to me, I teach my lessons three or four different ways, because I recognize that all of my students learn differently. So it's really introducing three or four different ways of learning the same topic. And what he said about my son was, what he's doing is he's taking a little bit from each methodology that I'm teaching and creating his own method, which most students will do. So it's just recognizing that we all learn differently and introducing the same topic in multiple different types of modalities. Unfortunately, in our universities right now, the universal design of learning that's being taught is happening mostly to our special education majors and not for our mainstream classroom teachers. So one of the things that I know our universities in Maine are working on is those who are majoring in education, K through 12 education, encouraging them to minor in special education so they get that UDL training, and also looking at dual certification for our education majors. So it's really a tool that can benefit all of our learners in all of our classrooms.
All right, we only have less than a minute left. Diane in Blue Hill, are you able to ask your question quickly?
This is Kiki, who has CP and low vision. You want to ask a question?
Hi. I think that there should be something to make kids with my disability, able to, see better and walk better, and yeah.
So, Kiki, how old are you?
So I'm 13. I go to the Blue Hill Consolidated School in Blue Hill.
Great. And I'm going to guess, Dylan, you're going to tell Kiki you want to meet her.
I would love to meet you, Kiki. We have some groups you can join.
Kiki, thank you so much for calling in. And the organization that Dylan is with is called the Maine Parent Federation. I'm sure you can find that online. Thank you so much for calling in. And thank you to all of us for joining us. Dylan Campbell and Carrie Woodcock, both with the Maine Parent Federation, and Atlee Riley, Managing Attorney for Education Advocacy with Disability Rights Maine. Today's sound engineer was Chris Bridges. We had help from Nick Godfrey. And thank you to our ASL interpreter, Marisa Zastro with MG Grant Interpretation. You can watch today's show on Maine Public's YouTube channel. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the 250th birthday of our nation kicks off with a celebration of Paul Revere's ride. We'll learn some of that history. This is Maine Public Radio.